We are in Genesis, finishing up chapter 5, beginning chapter 6 tonight. And in chapter 5, verse 25 through 27, I want to look at the name Methuselah, just show you something from the Hebrew. It's on the first page of the notes. I may find this more interesting than you do, but here it is. It says, when Methuselah had lived 187 years, he fathered Lamech. Methuselah lived after he fathered Lamech 782 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Methuselah were 969 years. Now Methuselah was the name Enoch gave his son. And Enoch apparently had a vision. He walked with God. He was taken by God. And Methuselah, if you look down there, I've got Genesis 5:22, also in the Greek, Hebrew text box there. And the word Methuselah is in a box. And the word Methuselah is made up of this. In the Hebrew, you're going to have, if I can do this, I don't know if I should even try. There, going backwards, there's the M sound and then the T sound looking like this. It should be written a little bit nicer than that. And the point here is there are no vowels. That's M, that's T. M, T, reading backwards. That's this sound right here. And then you're going to have, following that, you're going to have the shalah sound right there, and that is going to be the sheen right here, which is going to, we're going to put that there, the SH sound, and then the lamech like this, which is an L sound. Now notice they're all consonants, ending with an H sound, like a CH, a hard H sound like this. This has got the two legs on. This has got just nothing here. So that would be like a CH or just an H sound as it ends right there. Now, there's no vowels. If you look on your notes, number 3, let's just say 3A. It says, according to Strong's, the root M-E-T-U is the word mat, M-E-T-H. See, M-T, and they're going to add in there an E sound and a U sound, which is the word mat, which for means man. So this would mean with that A sound, this becomes man. The following word, shalak, notice no vowels. Vowel points weren't added to Hebrew until 650 A.D. Although up until that time, they just knew how to pronounce it. They just assumed. It's kind of like when we write words, or you ever seen someone just write vowel or consonants, and we just know what the word means. We provide the vowels. And there's, even if there could be like another vowel that would work, it would make a word, but in that context of those others, it wouldn't make any sense. So you automatically would just read in the correct vowel, if you know what I'm saying. You've read something before where someone just puts down a bunch of consonants and you can just kind of sound it out. Well, that's how they read Hebrew. And then eventually, as they began to speak more Arabic, Aramaic, and then eventually Arabic, because the Muslims took over and the Mediterranean area, and the Hebrews began, or the Jews began to speak more Aramaic, and they began to forget. And so they had to start, well, how did we say this? And go back and put the vowel points in. So the vowel points were not there until 650 A.D., around that time. Okay, so if you put up here the A in this mat, and you put the E sound here, put a vowel point for an E sound here, shalak, it means this. It means man, and then shalak means weapon or missile. So it would mean, as I said last week, man of the missile, or man of the dart, or man of the javelin. Okay? And you can see down there in that Genesis chapter 5, verse 22, where I've got that box, the vowel points for the M-A would be, there would be some kind of an A underneath there like this, mat, and that would be mat, and then with the shalek would have these underneath it. This is an E sound. That would be putting an E right here, so Shelech. So man of the missile, which is fine. Okay, now point B, Apostle Meta. Okay, there's another possibility, meaning with the word metu, which may be derived from the word mot, meaning death. That would make this an O sound in here. You're going to have to put some kind of an O sound here. And then the addition of the U sound at the end, which would mean the U would mean the mot means death. The U sound at the end of this would be a implying there or his. So death, his. And this would just be a matter of moving the vowel that they didn't put until 650. So it would mean their death or his death. The shalak or missile or weapon, if it changes from an E sound, like this would be, and like I had the E sound here, if you would put underneath here an A sound, that changes that from weapon or shalak to selak, which makes it mean to send. So this would mean to send or death, his death, their death, sends. So it could mean man of the javelin, or man of the missile, or it can mean death, his death sends. And with that meaning, it can mean his end, his death sends something. And again, Enoch is naming him, and his death, either way you look at it, when he died, God sent the flood. Which leaves an idea right here. If you look down in the Hebrew, I've got arrows drawn from the math up to the muth, meaning it goes from man to die, and then the shelech goes from shelak to shalak, which goes from missile to send. And I just got that written there because I find that very interesting. It's right there in the word, looking at those vowel points. And so when he dies, it is sent. And clearly there's something being sent by God. Now we go to page 2. We're going to do something else with the word Noah, and it's a little more obvious. Or another word with another name, Noah. And it says, now Methuselah had a son named Lamech. Lamech had lived 182 years, Genesis 5:28 through 31. He fathered a son and called him Noah, okay, saying, out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. So it deals with the ground, the cursed ground, relief from work that is painful that we're doing with our hands. It says, this one will bring relief. So Noah, it's going to bring relief. There's something that they've got a problem, but Noah's going to bring relief to man from the ground. Lamech lived after he fathered Noah 595 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Lamech were 777 years. And so what you have right there is the word Noah, and I've got that in the box right below that. It's verse 29, and he called, in the Hebrew it says, and he called his name Noah, and Noah, N-O-A, and then in the Hebrew it's a, it's not just a asan, it's hak, noak. It means rest, okay? So the word Noah means rest. His name is Noah, and so you think Noah would mean he'll bring us relief or comfort. But it says the words are different. The word for comfort is N-A-C-H-A-M. N-A-C-H-A-M. It is a different word. So it's not like Noah will bring us rest because rest will bring rest. Noah means rest, but he's going to name, it says, out of the ground the Lord has cursed, and this one shall relieve us, relief from our work. And so the word nakam or nakam means to be sorry, to console oneself. And so there's just an interesting thing there. I've got it written down here. I'll read through the points. Number one, Lamech is the only one who gives the meaning for the name of his son. It would be nice if Enoch had given us a little more information. It's just the name, which had to do with relief. And that's relief from the ground the Lord cursed, man's work, painful toil. And I write point two, Noah means rest, but comfort is a different word. Noah, point A is rest. N-K-H-M is comfort. Now, both of these are used together in a sentence or in a verse in Ezekiel 5:13. I've got them in the boxes there. And it's in this context. It's just interesting. They're used together again in Ezekiel 5:13 when God says, "Thus shall my anger spend itself, and I will vent," and that is the word noach, "and I will vent," or rest. It's translated, "I will vent, I will rest my fury upon them and satisfy myself." And that is the same word over here, console oneself, or to be sorry. I will console myself or comfort myself. I will cause to rest, or I will vent, and it will bring comfort to myself. So in Ezekiel 35:13, God is the one that's going to vent, and in his venting, pouring out, finding rest, he's going to console himself. And the issue is the wickedness of Israel. He's going to pour out his judgment on them, and now I'm at rest. So in one case, we see God bringing rest to mankind. We think he's talking about it. And through Noah is going to be the source of where God is going to pour out his vengeance and bring consolation to man or consolation to God. Lamech seems to be talking about there's going to be some kind of comfort for man from the cursed ground that's going to come from Noah's life. But yet, it's God who's pouring out vengeance, and the only one that's consoled in all this is God, and that matches Ezekiel. And so point D, I write, comfort who? In Genesis, the flood would bring rest for humans in relation to the cursed ground. But when you go back and you read the Mesopotamian, all these, especially like the flood tablet here, the Gilgamesh epics, what is the cause for the flood? Again, now we're not talking Bible. We're talking the way the culture of the days after the flood recorded what had happened. I just write here, I say it again other ways, but it says in the notes, in the Mesopotamian flood literature, the flood would bring rest to the gods who were disturbed by mankind and could not sleep due to the constant disruption of the humans. Because mankind made so much noise, the gods got together and says, "It's driving us crazy. Let's just kill them all." And so that's what the flood tablets say. And so there's going to be just this universal flood that kill mankind so the gods could have some peace. It's like, put the kids to bed early. And so they wiped out mankind. But that's where one of the gods comes down and tells, in the Mesopotamian culture, tells this one individual whose name is listed, hey, here's what they're going to do. Build yourself a boat. And he builds a circular boat, puts a bunch of animals on it, and he survives the flood and repopulates the earth and goes on into the new earth. And that's what's taking place in these flood tablets. So in the Bible, there's that ideal of man's going to receive some kind of relief from the ground God has cursed. Yet the words are used in Ezekiel very similar to the way the words are used in the cuneiform as far as God's the one that's getting the rest. Now, again, this right here is also worth looking at as point three. We got, it's like Lamech understands what his father or his grandfather had said. He understands what his father's name Methuselah means. When he dies, it is sent. And so he names his son Noah, which will mean God is going to find rest and console himself. But Lamech, in a sense, is going to flip it and turn it into one of these things. Point three, Lamech is speaking like, is he speaking a wish? Like, I wish out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one will bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. In other words, Lamech is desperate and with the condition of mankind and his generation and wants. Is he wishing, praying for divine intervention to bring rest to mankind when God says, no, I'm going to bring rest to myself. I'm going to bring disaster like Methuselah means. Or B, is it a prophecy? Is Lamech prophesying? Lamech knows enough through Enoch and Methuselah that his son Noah will build an ark or do something to save mankind from this disaster. And when the disaster is over, mankind will continue. Because mankind has to continue. In Enoch's message, it could not have just been a message of destruction. I'm going to kill everybody. There had to be a message because the promise is the seed of the woman. That woman, her role is to keep the human race going. God promises we'll keep the human race going. It's not going to come to an end until the Savior comes. And also that from the woman, the seed of the woman is going to crush the serpent's head. So no matter how great the disaster of Methuselah's death is going to release that Enoch saw coming, Lamech knows something's good on the other side of this. So something's taken place. They know God's judgment is coming, but they also know that, well, there's got to be another side of this. There's got to be a continuation. And that's where the prophecy is. Noah will be, in a sense, a second Adam or an early Christ. Like, again, they don't know. They know Adam and they know Enoch, but they don't know where Noah's going. They know nothing about Abraham or nothing about Moses. They know nothing about Jesus Christ, the cross. They know nothing of that's all mysteries. Like we talk on Monday nights, that's all mysteries yet to be revealed. But they do know the seed of the woman. They do know the prophecy of Enoch. They do know there's some deliverance coming. And just like we know, I was going to say think, but we know Jesus is the one who's going to take us into the new creation. We are new creations now by being born again, but we're being prepared for the new creation of the new heaven and the new earth. We're in that transition, being formed, recreated, and maturing for that stage. Well, in their minds, that would be Noah. Noah's the one that's going to take us into the next age. And when they got there, you know, I've said before, I think Noah got off the ark thinking something great. It's the millennium. It's the kingdom. He gets off the ark and everything's just mud drying up and you know, a little depressed, possibly. I read that into the text. But nonetheless, Lamech may have been looking for some great manifestation of God's deliverance from this mess. He's going to bring judgment. Like we think the second coming is going to be judgment, which it will be, but it's going to also be our deliverance into the kingdom age. The flood was going to be judgment, but a deliverance into a new age that was going to bring them relief from the cursed ground that they've been having to deal with, and we're going on in the new age. Or point C, besides a prayer or a wish or a prophecy of what he thought Noah was going to do, Lamech's words may foresee Noah's work in the vineyard as a producer of grapes. So you can put all those together. It may be as a prayer, it may be a prophecy, and it was fulfilled at some level when Noah began to produce fermented grapes, wine, for mankind as kind of a gift in this coming age, which is also interesting that one of the signs of the second coming or the millennial kingdom out of Jesus' own mouth is there's going to be wine. The prophets talked about wine. Jesus spoke about wine. Jesus even used wine as a symbol of this is the new creation. This is the new beginning. Okay, so there we have that idea, finishing up kind of from last week, those verses about Methuselah and Noah's names. And chapter 5 ends, after Noah was 500 years old, Noah fathered Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Of course, Shem is going to be the one who is going to be Abraham's descendants, Abraham is going to be a descendant from Shem, and then Ham and Japheth. And this picks up, like it says in point 2 there, in chapter 9. So we're going to go through chapter 6, chapter 7, chapter 8, and at the end of chapter 9, we pick this exact verse up, and we begin talking about the descendants of Ham and Japheth, and then going into Shem, leading on into Abraham. So that we'll just leave that there. Noah's got three sons. They're going to get on the ark with him. It appears that Japheth, I would say right now, Japheth is the oldest. Shem is 2 years younger. And then if we just play the odds, we'll say Ham's 2 years younger than him. Does Noah only have three sons? He may have had more children, especially since he's, 500 years old. He may have had many, many other children that all died in the flood. These may be the three that went with him on the ark. After he gets off the ark, he's going to have more sons and daughters. So there we leave it right there, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And now the focus is going to be on Noah and the ark and the flood. But we've got some major verses to look at here. And I'll read in Genesis chapter 6 in the NIV, and then we'll go to the text. And this is going to take us, it will take us a couple weeks to get through. I can shoot through it if you want me to. Just shoot through and just keep just flying through. But there are some things to look at here and things to be challenged or questioned. And at the end of the day, these first six verses, the first six verses, it's not clear. There's some that want to become very, very, very natural, materialistic with it, believing the Bible, but don't get too spiritual, not spiritual, too mystical, and I don't mean mystical, too, don't get too much out in the extraordinary, spiritual, angelic realm, and they want to keep it very, mankind. And then there's that ideal that something really weird is taking place, and then you got to be careful with that because you can get too far. There's extra biblical writings that like add into it, which you say, I can't go that far. So there's this level of just becoming very, very natural with these verses and getting a little more spiritual to the place you could drop off and get into very false teaching. So I'm going to show you some things. And most commentaries, they talk all around it, push to what they kind of think, but then back off at the end of these verses and say, we just don't know. We just, like the word Nephilim, we just don't know what we're talking about. In fact, I think I wrote something, at the bottom of page 3, and this kind of sums it up. I'll say it, then maybe I'll read it. But basically, the author, when I'm reading these verses, now you listen to me read these verses in the NIV, you can read them in the English Standard also, and our notes are in the English Standard. But when you read these, it's like, what are you talking about? What are the sons of God? And who were the heroes, the men of renown? I mean, what did they do? I mean, well, they're the men of renown. They're the legends, No, I don't know. But when the author wrote it, everybody knew. And then, of course, the Nephilim were on the earth at that time. And also afterwards. Okay? All right. So we're all together? Okay. Let's go on. It's like, well, maybe if it's 2000 BC, it's like, yeah. It'd be like saying, you know who's in the White House. You know what just happened this weekend. And so things have changed. This weekend, things have changed, right? We'd all agree. It's a new tomorrow. Okay. And then you start to, it's like, now in 200 years, 2000 years, next year, people are like, no, we don't know. What are you talking about? What was that? Who's in the White House? What happened this weekend? And so, meaning, there's that part, too, that we may be historically far enough down the road on the other side of the planet in a different language, translating out of a dead language, from where it was, and also with a different worldview, a different understanding of spiritual heavenly and earthly interaction, and far enough along the line that we can't even, we're blocked. We cannot understand these verses, not because they're so mystical and magical, but we've closed this door, we've lost this information, we cannot even look this way because we can't even imagine, that doesn't even make sense. So, again, I'm going to teach it, but also, when I get done, it's kind of like, and again, I'm not, in strange territory. Most commentators will do their best and then say, we don't know. All right. Chapter 6, after chapter 5, after the genealogies, chapter 6. when men began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. Now, beautiful can also mean pleasant, even referring to smell pretty. So whatever, you know, they were pleasant, they were beautiful. And again, daughters of men, I think we're pretty confident what daughters of men would mean. But if we're going to get into interpretations and, you know, try to find strange meanings, I don't think that'd be the place to start. They were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. And the word married is an idiom for, throughout the Bible, for married. Like, take them as your wife. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal, or flesh. His days will be 120 years. Okay. Now, it'd be really nice if we could, like, pinpoint 120 years, say, see? And then everybody lived 120 years from then on. But it's like, nobody lived 120 years. Some people, after this, they lived much longer than 120 years. And then eventually David's going to be told man's days will be 70. So you never really see 120, like, I mean, it really means, when you look for that number, and it's like 120 years, it means, I mean, I'm going to talk about it, but you can't say, well, go to this verse, you see, 120, 120. It's like there's no parallel verse for this. It's 120 years. Now, if that's not confusing enough, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. Huh. Before the flood? Oh, yeah, but also afterwards. Okay, why do we care? What's that got to do with the story? Okay, but they were. In those days, what days? Well, the days when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They had children, the sons, who are these sons of God? Who are the daughters? And are they having children? What kind of children? Well, the children, they were the heroes of old, the men of renown. Okay. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on earth had become. Now, again, we're switching subjects there. I mean, it's not like those are, because that happened, now we're going to have to do something about it. It's like, now, okay. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord, Yahweh, was grieved that he had made man on the earth. Now, that's enough to start three or four classes on theology, on how the Lord was grieved that he made man. It's like, didn't see that coming. Sovereign Lord who created everything out of nothing and spoke it into existence and knows the beginning from the end. He's the Alpha and the Omega. But boy, I wished I hadn't done that. If I had known that, I would not have done it. It's like, well, that can't mean what it means and maintain theology. So it's like, how do you play that verse? Well, God's not totally in control. God doesn't really know what's going to happen. He's waiting. He's just as surprised as we are when things happen. I don't think that's what the Bible says, but it sure seems like this verse surprised them, because why would God do something that's going to grieve him later? But we'll talk about it. But you can see how that could become a theology discussion. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. See, that you can see that heart was filled with pain goes back to when we talk about, and it consoled himself. He's going to do, you know, he's got, how do I fix the pain? I need counseling. I'm going to find relief by destroying these fleshly beings that are causing me pain. There, I feel better. He's going to bring judgment, which is true. The Lord is grieved that he had made a man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord says, I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth. Well, that doesn't sound like a very tolerant, woke verse. But nonetheless, this God, different than the God in Jesus in most churches today, is going to come down to the earth and just wipe everybody out because he's mad at them. So that's why you get the two gods. You got the New Testament God, you got an Old Testament God, because surely the Jesus that we worship and sing about in church, that loves everybody and is tolerant and accepts you just as you are, is not this God who just says, I've had about enough, I'm just going to kill everybody. So clearly there had to be a, I'm being facetious, I do not think there's two different gods. But you can see how some people have to do that to justify, or at least don't read the Bible. Okay. I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, man and animals and creatures that move along the ground and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Now, this is the account of Noah. Now, verse 9, this is the toledot of Noah. Now, if I would stay to form as we began in this book, this is the toledot of Adam. This is the written document of Adam. Right here, verse 9, we're not going to go there tonight, but I will suggest in verse 9, this is where Moses puts down the toledot of Adam, says, okay, well, that's everything I'm going to get from that paper, puts that book back on the shelf and says, now, about Noah's words. Now, this is what Noah wrote down. This is the toledot, this is the written document now of Noah. And he's going to now, and as you read this, it's, as I'll say it many times, but the writings here is going to give you the month, the day, the year, how high the water was, how low the mountains were when the ship sailed over the mountains. Like, how does Noah or Moses know this information? Is he God just telling it to him? No, he's doing research. He's putting this together. He's got the toledot. He's got the written book of Noah right here that he's editing together with the writings of Adam, possibly the writings of Enoch or somebody else that he's got in here. So anyway, that's all the further we're going to go with that. Now, with that being said, we look on page 3, chapter 6, verse 1. When men began to multiply on the face of the land, this is the English Standard Version, and daughters were born to them. So men are multiplying. Again, when we say multiplying, we're talking millions of people on the earth by this time. Again, it's the eighth generation is Methuselah, and then Lamech's children, Tubal, Cain, and Naamah in Cain's line. They're still all here. And then you got like the Sumerian kings list that we've got, wherever I've got, right here. They also have that eighth generation coming up, and then that's when the flood comes in the eighth generation. Now, Lamech is 9, Noah is 10, and so Noah's the 10th generation. Noah and his sons are going to go through the flood. Okay, so men are multiplying on the face of the earth, and it points out particularly, and daughters were born to them. I think that's probably drawn our attention to the women, the female, the one who's going to be producing the other men. And there's daughters that are born. I don't know if that's trying to say that there's been a lot of sons born and only a few daughters, and now all of a sudden there's more daughters being born. I don't think that's the point. I think it's just drawing our attention. Men are increasing, or humanity is increasing, not just men, but humanity is increasing. And now let's look at the daughters of man and see what happens. And chapter 6, verse 2. The sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive. I think it's pretty clear the daughters of man means women. Okay? I mean, I don't want to like spend time trying to show you the wording and stuff. They're the women. They're the female that was produced by mankind. There's women. The struggle here is the phrase sons of God, and they're going to see whoever the sons of God, sons of God, and this is in Hebrew Elohim, and this is Ben. Actually, it's Bene, but we'll just say Ben because that means son of, and Elohim means God. It can mean, and again, this is plural. He means plural, so it can mean gods, but in this case it means, this is plural, this is clearly plural in the Hebrew, sons is there, sons of God saw the daughters of man were attractive. So first of all, there's no doubt that these women are humans. Sons of God, I'm going to give you three basic choices from this, and you've heard this all before, But the sons of God are going to see the women. And they're going to see that they are beautiful. And like I said before, here it says attractive. They can also be, NIV says beautiful, English Standard attractive. I looked it up. I try to see if there's some secret hiding word that it could mean. It means pleasant, you know. And it just means, yeah, pleasant, beautiful, attractive. It's like, this is nice to look at. Now, another thing, they're seeing something. And that's something that Eve did. She saw the tree and saw that it was something she wanted. So here now you've got the sons of God. We don't know who they are yet. They're going to see, visually see the women. The sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were attractive. And right here, and they took as wives any that they chose. Now that they took as wives any that they chose, that is exactly what Isaac will do with Rebekah, Jacob will do with Rebekah. They're going to see them, they're going to take them, which means marry them, and they'll choose and take them to be their wives, and they became their wife. This isn't talking about immorality. This is not talking about, you know, running the streets, raping women. That's not what it says. It's right in line with they chose and took and they were married. So this is talking about, in that sense, they're talking about taking them as their own, if you want to say possession, their own wife, their own woman, bring them in to their house. Chapter 6, verse 4. I'm sorry, I went too far. Page 5, bottom page 5. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days. And also afterward, and now it describes, this is why we're going to see this part of it, it describes the same thing. When the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. Okay, so with that being said, turn the page to, and I'm going to give you a quick rundown here of your options. And again, I think you know this, and I don't want to bore you with it. But I do want to, maybe add some details. So there's three basic options. I've got a number 1, 2, 3 right there. One option, two option, three options, is the sons of God are the good boys. They would be like the sons of Seth. And the daughters of men are daughters of men, but they would be bad girls, like the line of Cain. So you're taking the chosen line of Seth and Cain. That's two. Everybody on earth comes from Seth or Cain at this time. And so this would be Seth's line, the good boys, and the bad girls would be, you know, Naamah would be one of them. You know, Cain's great-great-great-great-granddaughter. That's one option. So that would mean sons of God are men from Seth. The women, or the daughters of men, are women, but they're from a different line coming from out of Adam. Two, the sons of God are the sons of kings. The sons of God are royalty. The daughters of men would be common. Like they would just be, we'll say, middle class. So now what we're talking about here is we're talking about the royalty building a harem. They can just ride their chariots and I'll take her, and they're just collecting a harem. And they're taking just women. These are the daughters of men, would be just middle class people. The sons of God are royalty. They are ruling for God on the earth. I'll do the third one here. We'll go back and look at it. Or number three, the sons of God are angels, or some spiritual, they're a class of angels. And the daughters of men would be women, daughters of men, just anybody. They could be royal, they could be common, they could be slaves, they could be middle class, But the angels are seeing something, the beautiful women. And just like Eve saw something beautiful in the tree and wanted it, these angels, and she couldn't have it. She was not supposed to take it. These angels see something they're not supposed to have, but they want it. And so it's either the good boys marrying bad girls or the wrong lineage, the royal people, men, marrying common women, or it's some kind of angelic infiltration into the human race. Now, sons of God, point one, the sons of God are, the sons of God are good boys of that time that go to Sunday school, wear white shirts and ties, and don't drink soda before lunch. The daughters of men are the bad girls, probably descendants of Cain, who drink, cuss, and wear short skirts, probably chew tobacco, and obviously have tattoos. And so that is right there the reason God, that's his one of his initial reasons for, we're going to destroy everybody. We're just going to kill them all. Just wipe out the human race. I wished I'd never made man. If I'd known the good Sunday school boys with their nice, clean clothes, we're going to go out and ride motorcycles with the bad girls, I never would have made this. This is... Okay, so go for it. And some people teach that. It makes you kind of serious about, don't go to the wrong side of town. Okay, the sons of God, point two, are the sons of kings and pharaohs. They are the royal princes. Their daughters of men are the daughters of common folks, who the royal princes then gather together to form their harems. Okay? From the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Background Commentary, Volume 1 on page 43, I copied this. This idea of divine descent was a rhetorical expression of the divine election and legitimization of the king that is typical in royal inscriptions. So this right here is number one, good boys marrying the bad girls is lame. I think it's stupid, but lame is probably a better, This right here has some merit because pharaohs consider themselves the sons of God. The Mesopotamian, Nebuchadnezzar considered himself a son of the gods. If nothing else, like it right here, you see it in a typical royal inscription. Even today we can go back and see that we can see it in Romans that Paul considers that your governors, your leaders are divinely appointed. I mean, we could say, and I have no trouble saying it, that Joe Biden is in office because God has ordained it. I mean, he is God's leader for our country. Now you say, well, I don't agree. He's not, yeah, but he's the guy God wants there. You deserve him. I mean, America deserves our leader. Now again, we can bring it all the way up to today that our leaders are what we deserve or divinely appointed. And Paul builds on that supports that idea. I'm just giving you an example. And then you read it all the way back. These guys are going to think they're actually, somehow divine. Throughout the biblical period, it was part of the royal prerogative to claim divine heritage. You see, everybody, you become a king, you must be God's son. You must be chosen. Now, we're not talking God's son like, one and only son. God became man. We're talking God's appointed leader. Thus, the title, Son of God, now again, notice this, it's singular, Son of God, can be identified as a royal motif, both in the Bible and outside of it. So, I mean, this is Son of God is typical. Point B, it continues, nevertheless, though it is common for kings to be portrayed as having divine parentage, you are Son of God, there is no precedent for ancient kings, plural, as a group being referred to as sons, plural, of God. You see Nebuchadnezzar, Sennacherib considering himself a son of God, but you don't see Sargon and all of his children being sons of God. the individual king is a son. Now that would be, if you're going to use this, you're going to have to say it's a singular son of God. You don't see a whole class of sons of God in the palace. There's only room for one son of God in the palace. You got a bunch of sons of God in the palace. So that's a negative. Point C, this would be basic polygamy with a royal harem being formed. This was a practice. Again, if this is what the sons of God were royalty, and they're just taking middle class women, common folks, into their basic harem. Now this makes sense. But understand, they're doing something. You say, well, that's not right. The king shouldn't have a whole harem full of women. Okay, I would agree that's not God's plan for marriage. But it did happen throughout the Bible. It happened in Egypt. It happened in Mesopotamia. It happened in Sumer. It happened in Babylon. It happened in Solomon's palace. I mean, it's like, and so if God's going to start sending floods, and this is the example of why this is the days that the flood came, men started making harems, this is not going to go well. But it's like, this that doesn't really, the punishment doesn't really fit the crime, especially since the crime continued to happen throughout history. So, this was a practice the ancient world and throughout the Old Testament. It really doesn't seem to deserve mention here as an example of the wickedness of man that led to the global judgment of God. I mean, if this is your example of why God judged the world, it's like you can't do any better than the powerful men had a bunch of women. It's like, check out the rock stars, check out the rappers, check out the politicians, check out, well, whoever's got money. Okay, point three. Now this gets... I think number one, the good boys and bad girls is dumb. I think the royal family, the royal sons, marrying common women, forming a harem, has some traction because you can see it taking place. The judgment really doesn't fit. This right here, the angels, the sons of God, oh man, I mean, you're talking about some strange stuff right here. And it's like, can this even happen? And here it is. The sons of God are, point three, the angelic creatures. The daughters of men are the daughters of men. Give you an example. Gilgamesh, right here. This is the flood tablet. It's the Gilgamesh tablet. It talks about the flood in here. In fact, Gilgamesh in this tablet goes on a journey. Many things take place, but Gilgamesh on this tablet is looking for eternal life, and knows that there's a man on the other side of the river far away. He's got to go through the forest, fight his way through it, to go see the man who somehow has the secret to eternal life or never-ending life because he lived through the flood. So as you read this, it's talking about an old man who lived in the days before the flood, lived through the flood, and that his name would be in this document, but it would either be Noah or Shem. If this was, you know, and this Gilgamesh that's mentioned here is an actual historical king, mentioned on, his name is also here on the Sumerian king list. Now, a lot of legends and epic stories are written about him, but it's just interesting that he goes to a faraway place, like goes across the Euphrates and goes up north and goes through the forest of Lebanon to get out by the ocean, by the sea, on an island where he can meet with the guy. And he does. He meets him and he gives him advice and then sends him back. And if with the Bible and this were to parallel, that would be he went to see Noah, who was still alive at the time, or Shem, who was still alive at the time, which isn't hard to imagine since Shem was alive way up here into, as we know on the charts, the days of Isaac. Okay. Anyway, Gilgamesh is a historical king of the Sumerian city-state Uruk, which we've seen already, who was deified after his death. A lot of times when someone dies, a king dies, they deify him. They put him on like Mount Rushmore or something and make him into a god. He ruled somewhere between 2900 to 2350 BC. So he would be reigning, you know, right in this time period, you know, 2900 right here. Gilgamesh became a major figure in Sumerian literature. written 2112 to 2004, right around being written and edited down during the days of Abraham. Inscriptions that exist yet, not just poems and stories about him, but inscriptions by a contemporary official under Gilgamesh was discovered in an archaic text that in Ur that reads, "Gilgamesh is the one whom Utu has selected." And that was an inscription. Not talking about a legend, but like, he's our king because this god chose him. The Tumel inscription is a 34-line historiographic text written during the reign, 1953 to 1920 B.C. Mentions historical Gilgamesh, crediting Gilgamesh with building the walls of Uruk. And there's the lines written right there, and that's an inscription for a building or a wall in a city that's there that they wrote, "Gilgamesh did this." So that puts him in the area of historical. And Gilgamesh is listed on the Sumerian king's list. Now, in Sumerian literature, when it starts talking about him, they're writing about him, Gilgamesh is two-thirds God, one-third human. Gilgamesh is said to have, quote, "the flesh of the gods." And he is said to be 18 feet tall. That is from the writings throughout the ancient in cuneiform writings. All right, so nonetheless, there is an example of that they considered part man, part God, and had supernatural strength, supernatural size, and legends were written about him, men of renown. One of those phrases, men of renown, it gives the idea of men that are never going to be forgotten. In other words, here we are, we're still talking about them. Point B, sons of God, this phrase, Bene Elohim, that you saw in the box, I'm going to give you some examples. Sons of God in Job is parallel with angels in Job, in Psalms, in Daniel. Same Hebrew phrase, Bene Elohim, sons of God. Angels are called sons of God. Here we are. Job 1:6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Some Bibles simply translate that angels came to present themselves before God. They just translate it. Some translations, they translate sons. Now, again, every time a word pops up, you don't have to translate it the same way every time, because sometimes it's got this meaning in the text, and some in the context, it's got a different reference. But just keep in mind, here, sons of God, Satan is one of, or comes along with the sons of God, and they're presenting themselves before God. This is, I don't think anybody thinks, the good boys are presenting themselves in the heavenly courts along with Satan before God, nor do they think the royal kings of the world are ascending into heaven to present themselves before the Lord along with Satan. They know, everyone knows, this is a council of the angelic host, along with Satan's with them, because he's an angel, presenting themselves before God. Job 2:1, again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. Job 38, verse 7, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Now this is, I go back in 38, Job 38. This is saying when God is saying when he created the earth, Job wasn't there, but yet all the angels were singing. Job, you can't even ask me a question, because when I created the earth, where were you? I know the angels were singing, the sons of God, or the, what does it say? Sons of God shouted. The morning stars sang, and the sons of God shouted for joy when they saw the creation. So there's a in Job. Now, Job is a storyline. Psalms, now, you know, Psalms are. They're poetry, lyrics. Psalm 29:1, ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings, is the translation in the English Standard Version. Ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings. In the footnotes, I got there in the brackets, in the English Standard Version, the Hebrew says, sons of God or sons of might. In other words, Elohim could also be translated might. So right there, ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings, or ascribe to the Lord, O sons of God, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. And that's talking about angels giving God glory and credit for what he has done. Psalm 89, 6 through 7, similar. For who in the skies can be compared to the Lord? Who among the heavenly beings, or sons of God, is like the Lord? Again, that's saying, who among the sons of God is actually like Yahweh? Now, they're sons of God, but they're angels, they're spiritual beings, but they're not like Yahweh. Obviously, we understand that. A God greatly to be feared in the council of the Holy One. So that's that council of them all coming together. He's greatly to be feared and awesome above all who are around him. So clearly, sons of God in Job and Psalms is clearly referring to angelic beings. And finally, Daniel 3:25. This is when Daniel's interpreting the dream for Nebuchadnezzar. He answered and says, but I see... Excuse me, I'm wrong. This is the fiery furnace. He answered and says, but I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. So again, what I think that's Nebuchadnezzar speaking. He's looking in there. He says, I see three. I put three guys in there, but I see four, and that fourth guy looks like a son of God, or the son of the gods, or excuse me, yeah, son of the gods. So that's not exactly the same, but it's close. So there is cuneiform, and I can give you more examples of people being some kind of a mixture of angels and women. We've got here the sons of God being referred to as angels. Obviously, I think this is this third choice, that the sons of God are some kind of angelic being. And then I find support in the writings of Jude and the writings of Peter about angels when they sinned, being sent to Tartarus, locked up in chains, meaning this has not happened again. We've had harems formed again. We've seen good boys marry bad girls since then. We've seen all kinds of things, but you have not seen this, which opens up the next category of the Nephilim were on the earth in those days when all this was going on, and also afterwards. All right, so chapter 6, verse 3. I'm going to read this, and we're going to come back to it. What time is it getting to be here? Chapter 6, verse 3. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in or contend with man forever, for he is flesh. His days are 120 years. And so you've got to decide, 120 years right there, is that, okay, I'm tired. I'm not going to keep man alive forever. He's going to have to die. Let's say 120 years, then he's going to die. Well, that could be, but Abraham's going to live 175 and is going to taper down. Eventually, David's going to live 70. So it takes about 1,000 years to get to 120 and then down to 70. And that could be more likely, you understand, he's looking at the situation and says, I'm not going to put up with this forever. I'm not going to put up with this kind of stuff going on forever because man is mortal. I'm going to give him 120 years. And then we're sending the flood. So this would put you wherever the flood's at. This would put you, this chapter, 120 years before Methuselah dies. So he's saying there's 120 years. Most commentators go with the 120 years until the flood. But again, it's not that clear. And the reason he's doing it is God is flesh, or man is flesh. Okay, chapter 6, verse 4, I've got to quit. The Nephilim, now understand, we've talked about women, sons, daughters of man. We've talked about the sons of God. And you can decide what you think that is. They're going to have offspring. Okay? So if this is a woman and this is a royal man, or this is a woman and this is a bad woman, this is a naughty or a good guy, either case, those are men. And so their offspring are what? More men. They're just mom and dad are from a different class, or mom and dad are... they go to two different churches, or they're two different cultures. They're just men. But if these are angels, some kind of spiritual species, And these are men, daughters of women, daughters of men, women. Then these offspring are some kind of hybrid. They're half man, half angel. They're like, they're not supposed to be here. They're something that God doesn't want on the earth, and he's grieved that this happened. In other words, he's not grieved that he made man particularly. I mean, again, he says he's grieved that he made man, but he's not going to wipe mankind out, but this is not part of the plan. Now, and again, Nephilim. It says, then the, okay, chapter 6 verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. What days? And also afterwards. When the sons of God went to the daughters of men and bore children by them, then the Nephilim were also there. Now, I like to say the offspring were the Nephilim. But that's not what it says. It's not explicit. So instead of, you know, instead of running, it's like, so we've got four definite groups here: men, angels, half-breeds, and Nephilim, which are not this. They're not angels. They're not men. They're, what is this? With the flood, God stopped these sons of God from ever doing this again. So these, once the flood kills these, they're gone, according to my thinking. But mankind, man and women, will continue, because there's a woman and there's a man on the ark. And God says himself, and the Nephilim are there, they're in numbers, they're there in numbers. And so the English Standard Version translates Nephilim as giants, which would put our Gilgamesh in that category. On page 6, I got to quit out of respect, but there's your word Nephilim. Literally, it means fallen ones. It comes from the word that means to, well, I'm trying to see where my notes are. It means to lie down. It means to fall down. And so these, the Nephilim are on the earth. It would be the fallen ones, those that apparently have been defeated or have lied down on the ground, maybe position-wise, were on the earth in those days and afterwards. And we'll have to pick that up. Your best clue for Nephilim is right there on page 6, Numbers 13, verse 33. When the spies go into the land, they saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim, and we seem to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seem to, or so we seem to them. So they say they saw the Nephilim. Now some people say they didn't; they were just afraid, so they told everybody, "Oh, the giants are there! The giants are there!" But there's really no giants; they're just trying to scare everybody. Except later on in Deuteronomy 9, Moses is speaking. And the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. So the Nephilim produced the sons of Anak. And the sons of Anak, in Deuteronomy 9, verses 1 through 3, Moses says, "Hear, O Israel, you are to cross over the Jordan to go in to dispossess the nations greater and mightier than you, cities great and fortified up to heaven. A people great and tall." See, you're going to go against a people great and tall. Moses isn't lying. He's telling them, you're going to go in there in the power of God, and you're going to meet a people great and tall. Sons of Anakim, which is sons of Anakim, who the spies, or the, when they whoever wrote Numbers, Moses, says the Anakim or the Nephilim produced the Anakims. Whom you know and of whom you have heard. Now that's interesting, because that's exactly what Genesis, these are the men of renown. These are the men people are going to remember. And now on the other side of the flood, on the other side of the Exodus, you're going to go in there and you're going to meet the sons of Anak. You've heard legends about these guys. These are the stories you tell your kids around the campfire. You're going to be meeting them. You're going to see them face to face. Just like Genesis says, you're going to talk about these people. whom you know and of whom you have heard it said, and here's what they say about him, who can stand before the sons of Anak? If the sons of Anak show up, it's just give up. But you're not going to give up. You're going to take them. And then he goes on and tells them that. So again, the Nephilim, we got to clean this up some more and add some more to it, because there's a lot going on right here, and it's enough to flood the world, wipe out mankind. And I think there's got something to do with the angels and what is taking place. If you look on page 7, the Nephilim could be, just see right there, you got all the things. Oh, I'll show you this too, now I'm going to quit. I said that already, I know. But page 11, that's right out of the framework book. That's just copied and pasted out of the framework book, talking about the sons of God, the Nephilim. And I'll read more of this next week. Quotes by Josephus, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, Tertullian, New International Dictionary, First Enoch. But I can tell you, Josephus, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, and Tertullian, they did not think it was option number 1 or 2. They're thinking these sons of God and the Nephilim are something supernatural, and not the good boys marrying bad girls or kings building a harem. They're seeing something bigger take place here, and I think so too, and it makes sense. I think it was Satan's attack to destroy the seed of the woman, to pervert the bloodline, to genetically infiltrate humanity, so God's promise that the sons, the seed of the woman would crush the serpent's head, he's going to infiltrate it so that there's no possible seed of the woman left that could crush his head. He's infiltrating. And that's why it says in Hebrews, for surely it's Abraham's descendants, not angels. God has not helped the angels. He's going to save Abraham's descendants, not the angels. So I think it's a satanic attack against the promise in the garden. And if God hadn't stopped it, that we would have lost it, if that's possible. But God said, no, we're going to stop this. And then they were locked up. We'll talk more next week. I appreciate you being here. It really means a lot to me that you're here. Father, we thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your word. I ask that we would handle it diligently, that we would not speculate, but we would allow it to lead us in truth, give us something solid to stand on, and that we would learn to trust in you more and more each day. We ask that we might speak the things you want us to speak and live a way that is pleasing to you, especially at this time. And we ask for salvation in our own nation, that we may see more good days ahead of us. And we ask for revival in our land. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience.